"Namah will surely bless you for the service you have given," I whispered. Master Chiala grunted an unintelligible response and laid the tapper against my spine, striking it smartly. 100 needles pierced my skin, bearing pigment to limn it indelibly. I closed my eyes, awash in pleasure at the exquisite pain of it. And no matter what else happened, this much I was granted. My mark would be made. No matter that I ventured forth into certain danger, I would do it as that which I had claimed to be to Voldemar Selig, a free d'Angeline.
"At least you've learned to lie still," Master Tialar said irascibly, and struck the tapper again.
Pain blossomed like a red flower at the base of my spinal column, suffusing my limbs. I gasped, clutching at the corners of the table, and proved him wrong. If Isandra had told him I was a hero of the realm, it made no difference. Master Robert Tialar was an artist, and I was his canvas. He swatted irritably at my writhing buttocks, ordering me to stillness.
"Damned Anguissets," he muttered. "Grandpère was right."
Later I had time alone in the room I'd been given to consider it. It was a well-appointed room, if a bit dark and frosty for my taste, but it was a hunting lodge after all. Still, there was a great oval mirror, gilt-edged, in which I could gaze at my finished mark. I stood naked before it, twisting my hair out of the way and gazing over my shoulder. In truth, the finished mark was stunning. Thorny black lines, intricate and powerful, rose from the graceful scrollwork at the base to twine upward the full length of my spine, ending in an elegant finial. The teardrop-shaped scarlet accents had been used sparingly, serving as vivid counterpoints to the black lines and my own ivory skin. Echoing Kushiel's dart, I had thought at the time. Now it reminded me, too, of the bitterest winter, of the scaldic wilderness, branches stark against the snow, spattered with crimson blood. Stunning and fitting. A knock sounded at the door, and I slid on the silk robe that had been provided me. I opened the door to see Isandra de la Courcelle and began to kneel.
"Oh, stop," she said restlessly. "I've ceremony enough in my life, and we're near bed cousins, after all, between de Launay and my father."
It was a startling thought, but Isandra gave me no time to dwell on it. "Was it done to your satisfaction?"
"Yes, Your Majesty."
I stepped back from the door, allowing her to enter. "It was a great kindness. Thank you." Isandra eyed me curiously. "May I see it?" One does not refuse such a request from one's sovereign. Silently, I undid the sash of my robe and slipped it off, turning. "So that is the mark of Namah." Her fingers brush the fresh-limbed skin, light and curious. "Does it hurt?" I repressed a shudder. "Yes."
"I beg your pardon."
There was a trace of amusement in the cool voice. "Thank you. You may cover yourself." I did, turning back to face her.
"You have never seen a servant of Namah?"
"No," Isandra shook her head. "My grandfather forbade me such contact. Virginity is too highly prized in a bride, especially among barbarians," she added wryly. "Arcadians, for example." "Blessed Elowa bid us to love as we willed," I said. "Not even the king can violate that precept."
"No."
She moved restlessly around the room, her pale hair like a flame in the dim light. "But you should understand. When you were a bondslave to an Arfiel de Launay, you could not spend the coin of your love as you willed, no? I am bondslave to the throne, Fedra. Still, I would obey Elowa's precept, and that is why I am sending you to Alba, to bear word to Drustan Mab Nectana. If you fail, I will still have the coin of my unsullied bridal bed. Elowa grant I have somewhere to spend it."
"I will do my best," I whispered.
"You have a gift for survival." Isandra leveled her violet gaze at me. "I can but hope it holds true."
Her tone changed back to one of curiosity.
"Tell me, why do Nama's servants bear such a mark?"
"You do not know," I smiled, shrugging my shoulders to feel the silk brush against tender skin. "It is said that Nama so marked the backs of those lovers who pleased her, scoring her nails against their skin. They bore the traceries of those marks of ecstasy all the days of their lives. We do it in homage, and out of memory."
"Ah," Isandra nodded once, satisfied. "I understand. Thank you."
She turned to go, then paused. "Your companion Hyacinth will return on the morrow, and you will make ready to leave. I thought you might like to have this. 'Tis small enough to port." She handed me a small, slim volume, much mended. I took and opened it, glancing at the pages, writ in an unfamiliar hand. "It's my father's diary," Isandra said quietly. "He began it at the university in Tiberium. It ends shortly after my birth. There's a great deal about Delaunay. That's what made me dare to approach him."
"In the players' changing room," I said without thinking, remembering.
I looked up at her shocked face and coloured. "It is a long story, Your Majesty. Delaunay never knew I was there."
Isandra shook her head. "My uncle was right. Whatever it is you do, Phaedrin O'Delaunay, you seem to do it very well."
Her violet gaze deepened.
"My father wed out of duty and not love. Eloa grant you spare me the same fate. I will pray for your safe return, and pray you bring the Prince of the Cruinia with you. No more can I do. I must protect the realm as best I can."
I grieved for her burden. Mine own seemed light beside it. "If it is possible, I will do it, my lady."
"I know."
We gazed at each other, the two of us, both of an age, yet so different.
"Be well," Isandra said, and took my head in both hands, laying the formal kiss of blessing upon my brow. "May Eloa bless and keep you. I pray that we will meet again."
She left then, leaving me alone with my finished mark and my book. Since I had nothing else to do, I sat and read. In the morning Hyacinth arrived, returning from the city. He had with him 3 rather good horses, foodstuffs in abundance, and 2 pack mules that would bear our gear. And he had clothing. For himself he would wear his usual garb, garishly colourful, covered over with a saffron cloak that was the Tsingani travelling colour. He had brought a like cloak for me, with a maroon-lined hood, that went over a blue velvet gown, with a 3-flounced skirt, with a maroon underlining. It was very fine, though a bit much, and the fabric was well used, the nap worn shiny in places.
"Tsingani discard nothing needlessly," he reminded me. "Phaedra, you will be my near cousin, a by-blow gotten in one of the pleasure houses of Knight's Doorstep by a half-breed Tsingano trader. You've the eyes for it, anyway, at least excepting the one," he grinned. "As for you, Carceline," Hyacinth held up a voluminous grey cloak, swirling it to reveal the lining. It held an opalescent riot of colour, madder, damson, ochre, cerulean and nacre. I laughed, covering my mouth.
"You know what it is?" Hyacinth asked.
I nodded. "I saw one once. It's a mendicant's robe."
"It was Telesis's idea. She conceived it with the Lady of Marsilicos." He handed the cloak to Jocelyn, who received it expressionless. "You can't pass as Tsingani, Carceline, not even a by-blow, and we need somewhat to explain your presence."
The wandering fabulists known as mendicants come from Isand. Among Eloa's companions, it was Aishith who gave to mortals the gifts of music and story. So D'Angeline's claim, our critics hold that she taught us to play and to lie. Be as it may, Isandines are the finest storytellers, and the best among them the mendicants, who are sworn to travel the realm, embroidering truth and fable together into one fabric. If any D'Angeline would travel the long road with the Tsingani, it would be a mendicant.
"Can you lie, Carceline?" Hyacinth was grinning again.
Jocelyn swung the cloak over his shoulders. It settled around him, dove-grey and sombre as his former priest's garb, until he shifted and a glimpse of swirling colour was revealed.
"I will learn," he said shortly.
"You can start with this."
Isandra de la Courcelle had entered unannounced. She nodded at one of her dour Castellane guards, who held out an armload of gleaming steel. Jocelyn's gear, daggers, vambraces, sword, and all. He gazed wide-eyed at the queen.
"The arms belong to the family and not the Castellane Brotherhood, yes?" Isandra said. "You offered me your sword, Jocelyn Verai, and this is the sword I accepted. You will bear it and your arms in my service."
A small smile played about her lips. "It is up to you to conceive a tale of why a wandering mendicant should bear Castellane arms."
"Thank you, Your Majesty," he murmured, bowing without thinking with arms crossed.
He reached out then and took his gear from the scowling brother, settling the belt around his waist, buckling on his vambraces, and slinging on his baldric. With the hilt of his sword protruding from beneath the mendicant cloak, he seemed to stand taller and straighter.
"You have done well," Isandra said to Hyacinth, who bowed. She surveyed the three of us. "All is in readiness for your journey. Fedra?"
She handed me an object, a heavy gold ring on a long chain. I took it and looked. It bore the Courcelle insignia, the swan crest.
"It is my father's ring," Isandra said.
She held up her hand, which bore its twin.
"I wear my grandfather's now. You may show it to Quintilius Rouse if he doubts the truth of your word. And when you gain the distant shore of Alba, give it to Drustan Mab Nectaner, that he might know from whence it came."
"He will know it. I have worn it since my father's death."
"Yes, Your Majesty."
I lifted the chain over my head and settled the ring under my clothing, where it lay below Melisande's diamond.
"Good,"
Isandra said simply. She held herself proud and upright, letting nothing but courage show on her face. She was the queen. She could afford to do nothing less.
"Blessed Eloa be with you all."
It was a dismissal, and our order to go. Hyacinth and Jocelyn bowed. I curtsied. And thus did we set out.
Chapter 61. The place to which we were bound was called the Hippocamp. One thinks of Cushith as a harsh and stony land, but of course this is only true of the outermost verges. Inland, it is as rich and fertile as any of the seven provinces, with deep valleys cut through by mighty rivers. We would travel westward across Lanyas, taking the Senescene forest road into Cushith, or so Hyacinth believed. He could not be sure until we intercepted one of the Chedrov, the imperceptible markings that Tsingani leave along their route. It would not matter over much in Lanyas, which was under the Comte de Sommerville's rule and peaceful. Of the companions, Arniel's gift was husbandry, and he taught much to mortals of the growing of good things and the care of the land. It made for a peaceful province, although Lanyasites are fierce as lions when roused to defend their land, as Percy de Sommerville's noble history as the royal commander evidenced. Good weather graced our leave-taking, a damp early thaw rendering the air moist and gentle. Despite my fear at the vastness of our undertaking, I found myself in good spirits to be riding once more. Truly, nothing is worse than waiting idle, while fear preys on one's mind like ravens upon a corpse. And after the frozen terrors of Scaldia, the Senescene seemed almost friendly. Our first day proved uneventful. We saw no one, save a few farmers at early tilling for spring crops, who nodded in taciturn acknowledgement. Once we gained the forest road, we rode in solitude. Hyacinth made for a cheerful companion. He had brought a hand-held timbal, which he played as he rode, his nimble fingers drumming and jangling out a merry rhythm. After our terrible journey of desperate, hurried silence and secrecy, it seemed odd and dangerous to Jocelyn and me, but I saw the wisdom in it. Tsingani do nothing quietly, and there is as much deception in noise as there is in silence. It was after we had paused for a luncheon that we saw the first sign of Tsingani on the road, passing a campsite near a forest stream. Scorched earth and scraps of metal gave evidence that a travelling forge had been erected there, and the Tsingani are known to be smiths. Hyacinth scouted the area and loosed a shout of triumph. We hurried to his side, and he pointed to a split twig planted in the ground, one side bent westward.
"A Chadrov," he said, nodding. "We are on the right route."
So we continued our journey, following such Tsingani signs as Hyacinth espied. Indeed, all of us grew adept at spotting them. I will not speak over much of these travels, for the days passed without incident. From Hyacinth we learnt somewhat of Tsingani ways, preparing ourselves for what we might find. In turn, I taught a few words of Kruinya to both he and Jocelyn. It is more difficult than Skaldic, for there are sounds in the Pictish tongue that come hard to D'Angeline's. I had always despised the fact that Delaunay had made me learn it. Ironic that I should need it so direly now. The remainder of the time I passed in reading the journal of Prince Roland de la Courcelle, that with which Isandra had gifted me. From this slim book I pieced together the great and fateful romance that had bound Anarfiel Delaunay's fate to the protection of Isandra de la Courcelle, and indeed made of me what I was, a courtesan equipped to match wits with the deadliest of courtiers. They had met at the university in Tiberium, of course. That much I had known. But I glimpsed Delaunay now through another's eyes, as a young man full of beauty and a splendid passion to know. I had never known Delaunay as a youth. It surprised me to read his poems, carefully recorded by Roland de la Courcelle, wicked, biting satires that lampooned fellow students and masters alike. And it was Roland who began calling him Delaunay, after his mother's name and the Isandine shepherd lad Eloa had loved. Once they were together, and I blushed to read that passage, wondering how Isandra had taken it, it was the masters of the university who nicknamed him Antinous, after a lad beloved by an ancient Tiberian imperator. Roland's nature shone through it all, a generous and reckless spirit who loved freely without reckoning the cost. Truer to the precept of Blessed Eloa and the archaic ideologies of glory than the political machinations of a monarchy. I could only imagine how Delaunay had adored and despaired of this careless nobility, incapable of subtlety. It was the death of Edme de Rocaille that had caused a rift between them after the university, after Delaunay had been castigated by his father and formally taken his mother's name. Hyacinth and I had not been too far wrong. There was a long-lasting bond between the houses Rocaille and Montrev. Strange still to think of Delaunay as aught but Delaunay, and Edme had been a childhood friend to Delaunay in Siauval, betrothed to Roland out of goodwill and because her family had ties to the royal house of Aragon. A good arrangement, it seemed. There was fondness between all of them, and Edme understood that she was trading passion to be the eventual queen of Terre d'Ange, mother of heirs. Then came her hunting accident. It was obvious that Roland genuinely grieved for her, and obvious too that he was blind to the possibility that Isabelle Lanvert had been involved, attributing Delaunay's vehemence to a mix of grief and jealousy. It is a human failing to attribute the best of motives to those we know the least, and the worst to those we love best. He loved too well, Roland did, and feared to be lenient in his judgment, and favour Delaunay because of it. He heeded Isabelle, who flattered and bewitched him, and they were betrothed, for House Lanvert was powerful, betrothed and wed. And Delaunay wrote his satire. I think that Roland knew when Isabelle sought to have him banished. I read what he wrote privately, for none to behold. of how he argued long and hard with his father, the king, on Delaunay's behalf. The agreement they reached was a bitter compromise. Delaunay would live and retain status such as his father's repudiation had left him, but his poetry was declared anathema. To own it was tantamount to treason. That much I had known. I had not known that every extant copy of Delaunay's works was gathered and burned, nor that Prince Roland de la Courcelle had wept at the conflagration. I dare say no one knew, save Isandre, who read these same words. Somehow, then, somewhere, they were reconciled, Roland and Delaunay. It falls within a gap in Roland's journal. He wrote only, "All is forgiven, though nothing is the same. If we cannot have the past, Ella will grant us a future." One might argue that he wrote of Isabel and not Delaunay, but for what followed. It came upon the heels of Isandra's birth, an event heralded in Roland's life with mingled joy and terror at donning the mantle of fatherhood. That his relations with Isabel had grown bitter was obvious to one trained to read between the lines. I hoped that Isandra had not discerned as much, though I doubted it. There was another gap. Then Roland wrote, "An Orfiel has promised, swearing upon my ring, and my heart is glad for it, though neither Isabel nor father are pleased. But who among us is whole? He is the wiser half of my sundered soul, and I can give my firstborn no greater gift than to pledge my devotion entire." And then, "It is done, and witnessed by the priests of Eloa." Shortly after this, Roland's journal ends. I know why, for he was caught up in the affairs of the heir of Terdange, and rode not long afterward to Cumlach, to the Battle of Three Princes, where he lost his life. "So many killed," I mused, sitting beside the campfire the night I finished my reading of his diary. "So much bloodshed." I had been a child still in Sirius House when these things had shaped Isandra's life. Mine too, had I known it. But that pattern was forming in the distant future. While I learned how to kneel uncomplaining for hours at a time, and the proper angle of approach for serving sweets after a meal, Isandra was learning how greed and jealousy corrupt the human soul. No wonder she clung to a girl's dream of love. I glanced at the well-worn journal, then toward the west, where dim streaks of dying sun glowed between the trees. We were near to Kushath now. If we'd not crossed the border already, it was hard to tell in the forest. Somewhere beyond the ability of my vision to scry lay the Straits of Alba, that wind-whipped expanse of water, as grey and narrow and deadly as a blade, separating Isandra from a dream. Not a mere girl's dream, I reminded myself, but a queen's. Isandra's blue boy might have hands that would lie lightly upon the crown, but they came gripping a spear, a thousand spears. It was a dream to pit against a nightmare, of d'Angeline heads bowed before the Scaldy sword. Thinking of Voldemar Selig, I shuddered. It was hard to imagine any Pictish prince who could stand against him, in all his brawn and might and the teeming loyalty of tens of thousands of Scaldy. And yet, the Scaldy had felt the hobnailed sandal of Tiberium upon their necks, while the Cruinia had never known defeat, and Drustin Mab Nectina was of Cynil Rhu's lineage, who had cast the soldiers of Tiberium from Alba. Such a slender hope, and all of it resting now upon our shoulders, this unlikely threesome. I clutched Roland's journal to me like a talisman, lifting my gaze to the emerging stars, and prayed that we would not fail. Chapter 62. The scale of the Tsingani horse fair at the Hippocamp caught me unprepared. Once we emerged from the Cenacene, our route grew ever more obvious, despite the increasing number of roads. As the dank cold of full spring eased into the true promise of spring to come, pale green buds emerged on the trees around us, and traffic grew steadily along the roads. And amid the travellers we saw Tsingani in numbers, the true travellers, journeying always upon the long road. There is another horse fair at the Hippocamp that takes place in late summer, when the most promising of yearlings are greenbroken, offered to the Gardia noblemen for outrageous prices. That fair, Hyacinth assured us, dwarfed this one, as did the fair in midsummer in Aishith. This was primarily a Tsingani affair, when there were opportunities to be seized early, untried yearlings and stumbling foals at auction, only their bloodlines and the cunning gaze of their breeders to recommend them. No one has ever made a count of the Tsingani in Terre d'Ange. They are too migratory to stand still for it, too suspicious to report honestly. I have seen them gathering, and I can say that they are many, more than we reckon. As we drew near to the Hippocamp, we passed caravans of Tsingani. It was a strange thing to witness the change in Hyacinth, for it was he whom they acknowledged, calling out greetings in their private dialect. And why not? He was young, bold, and handsome, one of their own. Hyacinth shouted back, waving his velvet cap, black eyes sparkling. Their tongue was mixed with d'Angeline, but I scarce understood a word of it.
"You didn't tell me I had to learn Tsingani,"
Jocelyn muttered to me, riding close by my side. "I didn't know," I replied, chagrined. Even Delaunay, scholar that he was, hadn't reckoned Tsingani a proper language. In all the time I had known Hyacinth, through all the meals I'd eaten at his mother's kitchen, I'd never understood what it meant to him to be a Tsingano. In front of me they spoke d'Angeline proper. I thought of all the casual cuffs and curses he'd endured from the very beginning of our acquaintance, when the Dawain's guard had found me. I hadn't known. I hadn't understood. When he took a broken-down nag and built a profitable livery stable out of it, I hadn't realized how deeply rooted in Tsingani tradition it was. I'd merely thought him clever for it. It is a funny thing how one's perspective changes. I saw Hyacinth through new eyes as we journeyed toward the Hippocamp. We passed Tsingani wagons, far more colourful and elaborate than Tavi and Darnell's humble Yeshuite conveyance, though similar in design, and the young women hung on the back, making eyes at Hyacinth. I learned to tell the unmarried ones, who wore their hair uncovered. They chatted and flirted as we passed, and Hyacinth grew more desirable with every exchange. If they seem shameless enough to make a d'Angeline blush, and some of them do, those Tsingani women, I will say that it is a deceptive thing, although I did not learn this until later. For all their licentious behaviour, it is only show. Among their own, the Tsingani hold chastity in fierce regard. But I did not know this at the time, and I will admit that it galled me somewhat to see the number of women who made free to bid for Hyacinth's attention. For Jocelyn's part, his appearance was met with giggles and titters, whispers passed from lip to ear behind shielding hands. The Scaldic women had ogled him openly. Tsingani dared not. The law of Luxter is fierce in their society. Hyacinth could not translate this word exactly, but it is the unsullied virtue of a Tsingani woman. This may be lost in 100 ways. Suffice to say that if I'd ever had it, it was long gone. But foremost among them was the mingling of precious Tsingani blood with one of the Gardia, the others. Once I understood the gravity of this law, I understood somewhat of the sin of Hyacinth's mother. Not only had she allowed her body to be defiled, to become Vrajna and unclean, but she had fouled her very bloodline. She had lost her Larkster, all her worth as a Tsingano woman. But they did not know this, the Tsingani en route to the Hippocamp. They knew only that Hyacinth spoke and thought as one of them. If a d'Angeline's fineness illumined his features, that keen-cutting beauty that is our bloodright, they saw in it only that he was a fine specimen, a veritable prince of travellers. And so he was, with his bright, fine clothes, rich brown skin, his gleaming black ringlets, the merry light that danced in his dark eyes. When he called out that he was seeking the Cumpania of Manoj, they laughed and called back, pointing. Manoj was there, the old patriarch already afield.
Surely he would welcome Hyacinth, blood of his blood, and all his uncles and cousins and aunts he had never met. That was his dream, the old dream, and it bode well to come true. I saw it as we rode, drawing nearer, in the eagerness that marked him, the white grin that flashed out without warning. It was a simple enough dream, and a homely one, to be accepted, to find a family. I prayed for his sake that it would come true. Hyacinth had risked much to come on this journey, and truly that and that alone was the reward he sought. But Jocelyn and I fell together as we approached, riding side by side and handling the pack mules with the ease of our long silent practice, and I saw the reserve in his blue eyes. He who had taken a simple vow knew well enough how things can twist and change. We reached the hippocamp. It is a field, nothing more, a broad green field, even now so early in spring. A vast expanse of green, the grass new and tender, alongside the great Lusard River that burrows the length of Kushith. We had timed our arrival well. A great many Tsingani Kumpanias had already arrived, setting up wagons and tents, paddocks against the new green field. But a great many were still to come, and we found ourselves a space easily enough, staking it at the corners with the bright ribbons Hyacinth had brought for that purpose. And everywhere there were horses, ponies, carriage horses, palfreys and hunters, massive drays and even war horses, broad-backed and arch-necked, mighty enough to carry full mail, but long-legged and swift in battle. There were yearlings, gangly and slab-sided, and the early crop of foals, some of them still staggering drunkenly on teetering legs, quick to tangle. In the centre of the field, where the most powerful of Kumpanias had established themselves, was a common area set around a fire. Already a good-sized group of Tsingani had gathered to play music, sing and dance. I thought at first that it was a fete, but Hyacinth said no, it was only their way. There were smaller gatherings, too, in the outlying areas where we had made our camp. As sunset drew nigh, cooking odours filled the air, rich and savoury, making our staples, flatbread and cheese, nuts, dried fruit and meat, seem duller than usual, for all that they were bought with the Queen's coin. Hyacinth, ever with a keen eye to chance, bartered with our nearest neighbours, trading a skin of passable wine for 3 bowls of a game stew, spiced with fennel and last year's carrots, with the assurance of meals to come. It was wisely done, for we made a friendship over it, in the quick and easy way of travellers. Our neighbours were a young family, not yet established as a proper Kumpania. Neki was the Tsereman, or headman, and introduced us to his wife Gisela, her sister and brother-in-law, his cousin, who had thrown in his lot with them, and a passel of children, who ranged in age from still suckling to 10 or older. They wed young. The women all came forward to give me the kiss of greeting. The men nodded their heads, dark eyes gleaming with curiosity. I've a good ear for languages, and had begun to be able to follow the thread of d'Angeline that laced the Tsingani dialect. Hyacinth had told them what we'd agreed upon, that I'd been gotten in a brothel by a Tsingano half-breed, adding, needlessly to my mind, that his mother had taken me in out of pity when she found me taking to the streets. Then he introduced Jocelyn, who bowed, making his cloak swirl with a subtle riot of colour. Neki's family laughed, and the children gazed wide-eyed. After that, they invited us to join them around the nearest fire, where Gisela's brother-in-law, his name I think was Pardy, would play the fiddle, which we did. The virtue of silence served me best there. I sat by Hyacinth's side and listened while he spoke with Neki, struggling to filter meaning out of the Tsingani dialogue. In the background, to my surprise, I heard Jocelyn spinning a tale in d'Angeline, and doing it fairly well. Gisela, her sister, and all the children were listening, a small group that grew somewhat larger as the tale wove onward through the skirls of fiddle-playing and nimble tambours. "And I said to the Scaldy Princess, 'My lady, although you are more beautiful than the moon and all her stars, I cannot oblige you, for I am sworn to Cassiel. And she said to me, Well then, if you will not wed me, you must fight my brother Bjorn, for no man may refuse me and live. Now this Bjorn was a mighty warrior, who had once defeated a witch, and she gave to him a great magic in exchange for her life, a bearskin that had the power to transform its wearer into a bear. I shook my head, turning my attention back to Necky and Hyacinth. A Castellane turned mendicant. Truly no one would believe it possible.
If it is true that you are the grandson of Manoj, Necky was saying, or something very close to it, then you must seek him out. The Baro Kumpei, the four mightiest Kumpaniers, are there.
He pointed toward the great fire at the center, where the state territories were vast, encompassing impromptu paddocks filled with many horses.
But if you are only seeking Tsingarni and Kushti Jaira to travel west and trade,
Necky shrugged, stroking the tips of his elegant moustache,
perhaps we would be interested, if there is Kokei in it. Perhaps enough to make our La Vaza Kumpania.
There is gold enough to make the name of whoever succeeds with me, Hyacinth said noncommittally, switching to D'Angeline and glancing at me for corroboration. I nodded solemnly.
I have many important friends in the city of Eloa, but none so important as blood, yes? I will see Manoj first.
Well, Necky said, and grinned, do not see him tonight, Rinkeni Chavo, for the old Singan Kralis is a gathering hellion when he drinks, and he's like to knock your dandos out with a kosh stick if you go claiming to be Anastasia's son. See him tomorrow and remember who gave you good advice, hey, Rinkeni?
I will. Hyacinth clasped hands with Necky, Tsingani fashion, at the wrist. Thank you. Necky wandered away to reclaim his wife and dance with her. They made a striking couple, bold and handsome. What's a gathering hellion? I asked Hyacinth, watching them dance.
You followed that? He asked, and didn't answer for a moment.
I don't know. It doesn't translate. Strict, belligerent. And Kushti Jaira? Rinkeni Chavo? Tsingan Kralis? He eyed me sidelong.
Delaunay taught you to listen too well. He sighed.
Jaira are horses. Necky says he has good horses to trade. Kushti Jaira.
Rinkeni Chavo?
Hyacinth looked wry. Pretty boy. I didn't tell him I was half D'Angeline. I waited, then asked again. And Tsingan Kralis? Hyacinth shifted his gaze toward the central fire, where the tents stood tallest, the wagons were brightest, and the finest horses in the paddocks.
King of the Tsingani, he said finally, his thoughts elsewhere.
You mean he really is? I was startled, and the question came out rudely. I'm sorry.
Don't be. He shot me a quick glance. I wasn't sure myself. But Necky said it. I always believed it, but...
I understand. I smiled ruefully and stroked his black curls. Prince of Travellers. Somewhere behind us, Jocelyn's story continued. He was acting it out now, giving the bear warriors terrible roar. Shrieks of terrified glee answered. The children loved it. The old prefect would have died of mortification. One of the young Tsingani women, long hair still uncovered, approached Hyacinth to invite him to dance. He looked apologetically at me, rising. I understood, of course. It would have looked peculiar if he'd declined. Unless we were a betrothed couple, and if I were no longer a Vrajna bondservant, still, as a half-breed's byblow, I had no claim to Larkster, to being a true Tsingani woman.
Which made me unfit for the grandson of the Tsingan Kralis.
It is a strange thing how pride may run the strongest among a people despised, as the Tsingani had been in so many lands. I thought about that as I sat alone near the fire, watching the dancers, watching Jocelyn spin his first-ever mendicant's tale. It made no difference to our mission. But it made a difference, I thought, to me. Chapter 63.
In the morning we went to see Manoj. The horse fair at the Hippocamp lasts for 3 days, and this was officially the first. The first day is for looking, that Singani say, the second for talking, the third for trading. While this is true, it is also true that by the third day, a handful of canny Gaja nobles would have gotten word that the horse fair was ongoing and come to buy, so the greater part of the trading would be all but concluded by the third day. Hence the deceptively casual undertone to the browsing and conversation, which was in fact in deadly earnest. To see Manoj, we had to take part in it, for Hyacinth was not so naive as to present himself and expect a welcome. Instead, we strolled around the paddock, surveying the horses. Jocelyn, who had been entrusted with our funds, mendicant or no, anyone wearing castellan daggers was the least likely target among us, had brought out the necklace Hyacinth had provided. I knew it well, for it had been his mother's, an elaborate affair of gold coins strung together. It provoked not a few whispers that a Didikani woman would dare sport at Singano garb. I understood those words quickly enough for half-breed and for coin-wrought jewellery, but it achieved its purpose. One of Manoj's many nephews spotted us in short order and came over to lean on the woven saplings of the paddock fencing to talk with Hyacinth, when he learned of our desire to contract horses and men alike to travel west for a lucrative trade, he brought us to meet with Manoj. We met with the king of the Tsingani in his tent, which was brightly striped and well appointed. I'd been expecting another ancient like Ganelon de la Courcelle, I suppose, but I had forgotten how young the Tsingani wed. It was hard to gauge his age. They weather quickly on the long road, but I think him not much over 60. He had fierce, staring dark eyes, iron-grey hair, and a resplendent moustache.
"You want to take my people and my horses west?" he demanded. "Who are you to ask such a thing? What is your compania?"
Those are not, of course, the words he used. Like the rest, Manoj spoke in the Tsingani dialect. Some of it I could follow, some I gathered from the general nature of the exchange, some I did not understand, and Hyacinth translated later. What I recount now is as I recall it, woven out of whole cloth like a mendicant's fable, only closer to the spirit of memory.
"I seek a handful of brave men and good horses to make a great bargain, Crawleys," Hyacinth said smoothly.
Manoj beckoned one of his nephews near and whispered in his ear, then shooed him away.
"Tell me of this trade."
Hyacinth bowed. "The Queen's Admiral and his fleet are docked at the Point d'Ouest. I have knowledge that they will be in need of horses." It was true, actually. If Quintilius Rous was going to take a single ship across the straits, he would need to have a handful of men well armed and mounted to ward the remainder of the fleet and secure their beachhead. Kushith was neutral territory at best, but none of us would divulge these details.
"I have not heard this," Manoj said dismissively. "Who are you to come by this knowledge? You have not given me your name or your compania."
"I come from the city of Eloa, and I know many people there and hear many things."
Hyacinth held the patriarch's gaze.
"I am Hyacinth, son of Anastasia. I am born to your compania, grandfather."
A middle-aged Tsingano woman dropped an earthenware cup in the corner of the tent. It fell with a dull thud, unbroken. Otherwise there was no sound. Manoj blinked wrinkled eyelids under ferocious brows.
"Anastasia's son," he said slowly, wondering. "Anastasia had a boy? A son?"
"I am her son," Hyacinth said simply. After that, pandemonium broke loose. It began with Manoj shouting for one of his nephews, a nervous man of around 40, who ran into the tent and threw himself upon his knees before the Tsingani patriarch. It ended with cries and embraces, and Manoj weeping openly as he drew Hyacinth up to kiss him on both cheeks. I pieced the story together later, for it was at this point that I lost the ability to follow what was being said. It seemed that the nephew Manoj had summoned, Chavin his name was, had run afoul of a Bryony House adept, the one and only time the Kumpania of Manoj had entered the city of Elowa. Bryony is the wealthiest of the 13 houses, for wealth is their specialty, in all its forms, and there are those to whom nothing is more titillating than money. If one stripped the staff of the royal treasury, one would find a full half of them bear Bryony's mark, for her adept's acumen is legend. Bryony is also the only house whose adepts are willing to wager for their favours. And they almost never lose, not even to Tsingani. I had believed, as Hyacinth had, that his mother had fallen enamoured of a Dangeline, for that was the story she had told him. It was out of love, to protect him from a more sordid truth. She had lost her virtue, her Larkster, because her cousin Chavin had laid it as a wager upon the table with a Bryony adept, believing he could not lose. Tsingani know a thousand ways to cheat the Gaja. He had lost. Not only had he lost, but in the face of the Dawain's guard at Bryony House, he had paid his debt with coin that was not his, deceiving his cousin, Manoj's daughter, who was young and desiring of adventure, into meeting with a patron who paid good coin to Bryony House for the pleasure of seducing a Tsingani virgin. It appalled me as much as almost anything I have ever heard, for it hit close to home for me. If she had been Dangeline and not Tsingani, it would have been a violation of guild laws. But the guild covers only Dangelines, leaving Tsingani and other non-citizens to their own law. It was a violation of Tsingani law, and Chavin had forfeited all his possessions and rights to Manoj, living as a pariah among them. Still, I think Bryony House is liable for heresy, for what was done to Hyacinth's mother violates the precept of Blessed Elowa, which applies to everyone, Dangeline or no. Nama's service is entered willingly, or not at all. As for Hyacinth's mother, she was Tsingani and bound by their law. She was Vrajna and outcast, in sorrow and tears, never to be redeemed. But now there was a son, Hyacinth, and even if he was a Didikani half-breed, he had been raised as a true Tsingano, and he was the son of Anastasia, whose loss Manoj had never ceased to mourn. His only daughter, his only child, his precious pearl, in the swarming mass of children his brothers and sisters had begotten, whose mulo had beseeched him on the winds since her death, a month gone and more. Prince of the Tsingani, Prince of Travellers. The remainder of the day passed in a whirlwind, as our campsite was struck and our things brought to join with Manoj's Kumpania, where trade and celebration blurred into one. Jocelyn and I trailed in its wake, bewildered and half-forgotten, as Hyacinth was drawn into an extended reunion with cousins and great-aunts and uncles he'd never known existed. Manoj kept Hyacinth close by him, drawing out the tale of his childhood and youth in Knight's doorstep, eking out the details of his mother's life. He was proud to hear of her fame as a fortune-teller, pounding his chest, proclaiming that no one had ever had the gift of the Dromond, as Anastasia had had it, among all the women of her line. I understood enough of this to raise my eyebrows at Hyacinth, who shot me a fierce warning glance, shaking his head. It was true what Delaunay had said. The Dromond was the province of women only. For a man to practice it was Vrajna, forbidden. When night fell, the fires blazed, and the Tsingani drank and played, their music rising in wild, skirling abandonment. Hyacinth joined them, playing his timbals, dancing with the unwed women. There must have been a dozen of them vying for his attention. I sat on the outskirts and watched his white grin flash in the firelight. So I sat, when an old crone hobbled over to me, wizened as one of last winter's apples, bent under the weight of the gold-bedecked galbi she wore. "Good evening, old mother," I said politely. She looked at me and cackled.
"Not for you, is it, Chavi? For all you've the evil eye to give, with that red mote you bear. Know you who I am?"
I shook my head, bemused. She pointed to her chest with a gnarled forefinger.
Arborati am I, and I was Anastasia's granddame. Her gift comes through my blood.
She turned her pointing finger on me, taking me back to Hyacinth's mother in her kitchen.
You've no drop of Tsingani in your veins, Chavi, for all the lad may claim it. Don't you know the Dromond can look backward as well as forward?
What do you see, then?
Enough, the old woman laughed wickedly. Pleasure houses, indeed. The lad spoke that true, didn't he? Your mother was a whore, sure enough. But you're no Byblo. No, not you.
I watched Hyacinth surrounded by his newfound family. Better if I had been, mayhap. My father had a name, but he didn't give it to me. My mother sold me into servitude and never looked back.
Backward, forward, your mother had no gift to look either way, Arborati said dismissively. His mother did.
She nodded at Hyacinth.
What do you suppose she saw, eh? The Lungodrom and the Compania, eh? Or somewhat else? A reflection in a blood-pricked eye?
She gave another cackle.
Oh, what did my granddaughter see for this son of hers? Think about that, Chavi.
With that she tottered off, bony shoulders hunching with laughter. I frowned after her.
Trouble?
Jocelyn said, materializing at my side.
Who knows, I said, shrugging. I think I'm fated to be targeted by Tsingani fortune-tellers.
I'll be glad when we're on our way. Do you think Manoj will give Hyacinth the horses and escort he asked for?
I think Manoj would give him just about anything, Jocelyn said wryly,
including Charvin's head on a platter if Hyacinth hadn't granted him forgiveness. That scene, with many drunken tears, had taken place earlier.
I just hope he remembers why we're here.
I'm not sure we're all here for the same reasons, I said softly, watching the Tsingani revel, Hyacinth among them. Not any more.
The second day is for talking.
Manoj had a half-dozen likely young horses, 3- and 4-year-olds, hunters for the most part, glossy coats polished to a high gleam, that would do nicely for patrolling rough borders. And he had, too, a half-dozen young men in his Compania, eager for adventure, willing to ride across the wilds of Outer Cushat on the promise of great trade, returning by slow wagon. It was important that Hyacinth appear astute. The haggling went round in circles until I thought I would die of tedium. Then the horses were examined one by one. We rode each one of them around the hippocamp, like hundreds of others, tearing about in spring madness, shouting and laughing, hooves pounding, a race without victors or losers, while the smiths, glancing up from the dozen small forges that had sprung up on the outskirts of the field, and grinned through soot-stained faces.
"Pulls up a little lame, this one does," Hyacinth said breathlessly, slowing to a trot under a stand of willows along the river,
greenish-yellow buds emerging on their long, trailing branches. We had lost Jocelyn somewhere in the aimless race.
"I think Grandpa G's testing me."
"Maybe so," I murmured. The exertion of the ride had brought out a touch of colour on his face. "Hyacinth, you know you're not bound to go to Alba. If you can help us to get to Quintilius Rouse, that's all you pledged to Isandra, after all."
"I know." My words had sobered him.
Hyacinth gazed across the hippocamp, the field bright and gay with his people.
I didn't know they'd accept me like this. I just wasn't sure. I didn't know it would be like this.
No. I looked at him with pain in my heart. But it is, and you are free to choose, Prince of Travellers. There was no need to spell out the fact that choosing the Tsingani meant losing me. Our friendship, what it was, what it might grow into. Or not. The promise of one kiss exchanged in a busy tavern. We both knew it. And knowing, we rode back to Manoj's campsite, where the old patriarch delighted to hear that Hyacinth was clever enough to have spotted the game-legged horse in the lot. On the third day, they trade. But our trade was done, or as good as. Our journey was set, with a half-dozen of Manarj's great-nephews ready to go forth with us on the morrow. I do not recall their names, but they were eager and bold, with dark, flashing eyes that looked sidelong at me, elbowing each other in the ribs at the thought of being on the long road with a whore's daughter, who had no luckster to lose, only the fear of the evil eye keeping open expression of it at bay. That and Jocelyn's hands straying toward his dagger hilts when he caught them at it. And true enough, on the third day, a handful of Kushalin nobles arrived, strolling the new grass of the hippocamp, looking smug at having the cleverness to steal a march on their compatriots and skim the cream of the early Tsingani horse crop. We watched them with amusement, sitting on folding stools outside the tents of Manoj's Kumpania. Some of the women had warmed to me enough to share with me the secrets of the Hokano, the myriad ways the Tsingani have devised to part Dongeline nobles from their precious coin. It was something to see, the way the proud, defiant Tsingani turned obsequious, helpful and unctuous, palms extended, silver lies flowing from their tongues. Out of kindness, I will not mention the name of the Kushalin Marquise, though I know it, make no mistake, who gave over a bundle of jewels and coin to one of Hyacinth's female cousins, who swore that burying it under the birthing spot of an all-white foal would remove the curse it surely held. Suffice to say that when the Marquise returned to the spot, neatly marked by a stake and a snow-white ribbon, 3 days hence, she and her escort would unearth an empty packet in an empty field.
"It is a kindness to liberate such things from the possession of a fool," Hyacinth's cousin said complacently upon her return, drawing the bundle from her bodice and fingering its contents. "Of course," she added, "even among the Gaja, there are those it is unwise to attempt." She pointed with her chin, Tsingani-style, across the field. I followed her gaze, and that was when time stood still. 4 or 5 of them, no more, and a handful of the house guard, riding slowly and gazing about, talking and laughing among themselves beneath the pale blue sky. Fine mounts, as ever, and the devices that set them apart. Long robes of night black overlaid with ornate gold patterns. Intricate patterns, and eastern, always different, the Shari's eye, with long, rippling, blue-black hair, faces as pale as carven ivory, set with sapphire eyes. There were 3 men buying war horses, and 2 women. One of them was Melisande. I had forgotten. How could I? How beautiful she was! Damnably and deadly, her flawless face, like a star among diamonds, small and insignificant, a Didikani outcast girl among Tsingani. I stared across the hippocamp at her, hot and cold shivers running across my skin, turning me to stone, hatred, and, ah, blessed Eloah help me, yearning. No one else, not even Delaunay, knew me as she did, knew what it was to be what I was, what I am, and ever would be. Every movement, every shift in the saddle, every slight change of pressure on the reins, I felt it, on my skin, in my flesh and bones. And on the heels of it came terror, for I was here not as a Tsingani half-breed, nor a servant of Nama, nor victim of Kushiel's dart, but as Phaedra no Delaunay, ambassador of Isandra de la Courcelle, the Queen of Terdange, and Melisande Charizai was the most dangerous traitor the realm had ever known. I saw brightness and darkness, while my breath came in sharp white flashes, and my heart beat like a frightened rabbit's, thumping fast and terrified in my breast. Voices surrounded me, speaking Dongeline and Tsingani, none of them making sense, none able to penetrate the sound that beat at my eardrums like the ocean, low and vast and thralling. Melisande's careless laughter, that I could hear no matter how great the distance between us. Faces swam in my ken, none distinct. I was aware somehow, some time, of hands shaking my shoulders, and Jocelyn's presence, fearful and urgent,
his hair streaming across the rising red tide of my vision as he shook me, sun-streaked wheat lashing a bloody haze. But it fell away, and there was only her. Melisande's face poised in a three-quarter turn, careless and beautiful, waiting to finish the gesture at any second, turning to look full upon me, 50 yards away or more, and see, completing the connection between us. Her diamond, a millstone around my neck, the velvet cord merely awaiting the touch of her hand on its lead. I was lost.
She will pass and see nothing. It was a voice hollow and insistent, penetrating my terror, anchoring itself in my soul and drawing me back. The veil lessened. I blinked, seeing Hyacinth's face swim into focus before me, his dark, beautiful eyes. His hands held mine, gentle and firm. In the background, the Shahrazai rode onward, small, ornate figures on prancing horses. "She will pass and see nothing," he said, repeating it. Sorrow in his voice. The Prince of Travellers had chosen.
Chapter 64. It was true that the Tsingan and Kralis cared deeply for his half-breed grandson, that I believe. But a silence fell after Hyacinth's words, like the silence when a great wave has broken, while another greater wave gathers. And then the outcry arose.
"Vrajna, he has been taught the Dromond. Anastasia's son speaks the Dromond. He brings a curse upon us all."
I will not recount the thousand voices that rose to vilify him. Suffice to say that they did, these great-aunts and uncles and cousins who had taken him to their hearts. Hyacinth stood beneath the onslaught, enduring, meeting my eyes in silent understanding. "Not for me," I thought. "Don't do this for me alone." He understood, shaking his head. It was not for me alone. Somewhere in the distance, the scions of House Shahrazai glanced over, mildly curious at the Tsingani uproar, bent on trade, acquiring steeds for a war no one else in the realm knew was coming, taking no sides, merely hedging their bets against the need. And somewhere an old crone smiled in vindication, 100 gold coins draped around her withered neck. Hyacinth stood unmoving. Jocelyn's daggers were in his crossed hands as he turned slowly in a circle, polite and deadly, warding me.
"Is it true?"
It was Manoj who broke the silence, fierce eyes anguished as he came forward, members of his Kumpania falling away before the patriarch's approach. Hyacinth bowed his Prince of Travellers bow.
"Yes, Grandpaji," he said softly, "I have the gift of the Dromond. My mother taught me to use it."
"It is Vrajna."
Manoj caught his breath as if it pained him.
"Chavo, my grandson, Anastasia's son, you must renounce it. The Dromond is no business for men."
If Melisande had looked in that instant to the disturbance in the Kumpania, she would have known. Even if she had not seen me, the circle, the stillness, Hyacinth at its centre, and a castellan warrior priest in a mendicant's cloak. She would have known, somehow, that I was involved. Delaunay had taught her what he had taught me, to watch and listen, and see the patterns emerging from chaos. We were alike in that. But Eloa was merciful, and she did not look. The Shahrazai had already spared us one casual glance. They were there to buy horses. And Hyacinth shook his head with infinite regret, his eyes like black pearls, shining with tears.
"I cannot, Grandpaji," he said quietly. "You cast my mother from the Kumpania, but I am her son. If it is Vrajna to be what she made me, then I am Vrajna."
What did she see? A reflection in a blood-pricked eye? I do not know. Only in the end that we needed Hyacinth. And the long road he chose was not the one that Tsingani had walked since Eloa trod the earth.
"So be it," said the Tsingan in Kralis, and turned his back on his grandson. "My daughter is dead.
I have no grandson.
A wailing arose then, and they mourned Hyacinth, as if he were not standing alive before them. I saw the blood drain from his face, leaving him grey. It was Jocelyn who held us together then, shoving his daggers into their sheaths, gathering our things, herding us out of the camp of Monodge's Cumpania. On the outskirts of the Hippocamp, we met Neki's folk.
"Are you still minded to make your name?"
Jocelyn asked Neki bluntly, speaking in plain Dangeline. The Tsingano glanced at us all, startled, then looked to his wife. She shrugged once, looked at the others, then nodded vigorously, beginning to summon the children. Somewhere in the background, the Shahrazai were concluding a deal, and I shivered as if with the ague.
"Good," Jocelyn said in a hard tone. "Get your horses and your things. We're riding west."
And so we did. It is a remarkable thing, the speed with which a Tsingani company can become mobile. I dare say most armies could learn a thing or two about efficiency from them. Neki's family had one wagon, a team to draw it, and five horses to trade. Only two were hunters. There was a brood mare and her foal, and a yearling besides. In a matter of minutes, Neki had concluded a deal for the mare and the younglings, trading for two more hunters and a rangy gelding of indeterminate ancestry. And in that time, Gisella and her sister had the wagon hitched and the family ready to move. Enough time, however, for word to spread. By the time we set out, they knew Hyacinth no longer existed in the Tsingan Kralis's eyes. I thought for a moment that Neki would back out of the deal, but then Jocelyn paid him a deposit.